Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, it's 1:30 in New York on Thursday, August 20th, which means that here is the 125th birthday of Howard Phillips Lovecraft. We're going to listen to some of his fiction and we're going to talk about Hugo Awards. There's an interesting similarity between the two this year. Stay tuned. Well, we really have to change the settings on this copy of the VLC player because I had it set up for a nice segue and instead it just started playing the intro again. So we'll have to manually force it.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I'm going to do something different this time because I finally got around to watching Ex Machina and something curious struck me that I want to talk about. Ex Machina was released earlier this year, and it's a tale of a young programmer who's drafted by a Steve Jobs-like entrepreneur to perform a Turing test, the process for determining whether an AI is convincingly human on a female-like android, has received a lot of praise. And that's well-deserved. The film is a dark, nicely restrained, and eerie examination of what it means to be human and what deserves to be called human, with a great otherworldly performance by Alicia Vikander as the android. But if Ex Machina plays as a kind of chamber follow-up to Blade Runner, another film, The Machine, plays as if someone saw Ex Machina and said, "Great idea! Can we make it a little more violent and beef it up with a stock evil military project plotline?" Because, you see, there are a lot of parallels between Ex Machina and The Machine that only start with the asylum-like knockoff title. The Turing test is cited in both, although it figures more importantly in Ex Machina. In both, the star androids talk with a fluting lilt, while the AIs in general communicate amongst each other via an indecipherable computer language, although that's more of a consequence in The Machine. In both, the perceived bad guy has an android-like Asian assistant whose moment of machine communication with the star android represents a dramatic turning point and even seems to be conveying the same message, while the heroes of both may live to regret the choices they make, although that's less ambiguous in Ex Machina. And then there's the look and feel of both films. Similar to what director Alex Garland did with Ex Machina, The Machine's director, Cara Dog James, creates a rarefied, sensual ambience where even the moments of explicit violence have their own kind of beauty. In essence, The Machine plays as the pulpier, more action-oriented doppelganger to Ex Machina. Except The Machine was actually released in 2013, 2 years before Ex Machina, which leads to the question of who might be knocking off whom. Granted, all of the evidence is circumstantial. Neither the Turing test nor the whole question of what constitutes human are exotic concepts in science fiction film, and a lot of the other parallels amount to not much more than set dressing. In addition, The Machine's overstuffed plot diverges dramatically from Ex Machina, taking in the hero's quest to save the life of his gravely ill daughter, the bad guy's plans to create android super soldiers, or cyborg super soldiers. The film frequently seems to confuse one with the other, and of course, culminating in the ever-popular robot uprising. In fact, if Alex Garland did take inspiration from The Machine, it's to his credit that he was able to say, if we drop all these rote sci-fi thriller trappings and just focus down on the core issue, then we've got a movie. But then again, I have no evidence that he actually did do that, which makes The Machine, at the very least, an interesting pair-up with Ex Machina for your next at-home double feature. And since The Machine is available on Netflix Instant View, that's a pretty easy thing to do. Won't cost you extra. There's no argument that Ex Machina is the better film. It's more focused, with a better grip on its speculation. But The Machine should not be quickly dismissed. Cara Dog James may not have the best control of his story, but he's not directing by rote either, and it shows. And if the unsettling, see-through body of Ex Machina's android is the more impressive special effect, The Machine's android, played by Katie Lotz, by the way, with sparks of electroluminescence coursing under her skin, is still a memorable image. I liked The Machine despite its flaws, even before I knew Ex Machina existed. Now, in the context of its justly praised brethren, it becomes an intriguing exercise in looking at the same theme through a funhouse mirror, although in this case, what's real and what's reflection has actually been reversed. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
And just in time, here I am happily chattering away with Kathy Davis and Matt, who's still here, working the premiums department faithfully. You people should know that, yes, there are those who do that. So, yeah, let me get off mic. I'm going to shout for a minute while I close the door and get out the papers that I should have had in front of me, because this is as ill, you know, I'm often ill-prepared. But what else is new? Okay, so, here we are now. So, Howard Phillips Lovecraft. I used to do a lot more Lovecraft, a lot more American horror, pardon me, and stuff than I do nowadays. Howard the Wolf has been on the air since 1972. And before that, I was interning and working for our drama and literature director until 1970, at least, Baird Searles. And you know, then I was partnered as a radio person with Margot Adler, who was carrying on the science fiction tradition while she was also a news director, a weekend news director. And Margot knew this fellow, ancient fellow, wonderful guy, by the name of Hans Stefan Santesson. I looked Hans up. He was an editor of pulp magazines and all that, and he knew a lot of people in the famous Lovecraft circle. I looked him up recently to see just how ancient he was. I am now almost 2 years older than Hans was when he died. And I don't think of myself as ancient. But then I would have been about, 18 years old at the time that I met this wonderful guy. So Hans introduced me to somebody else, a fellow by the name of Willis Conover. And there's actually a movement afoot to put Willis Conover on a stamp, because Willis Conover, whose politics were probably not the politics of WBAI, worked for the Voice of America. So I think that tells you a little bit about what his politics were. He was conservative, but a bona fide conservative, meaning, he believed in free speech. He supported BAI in many ways, but his politics were not, say, the average BAI staff member's politics. Willis Conover, can you hear, by the way, the sirens out in Atlantic Avenue? We really need those studios. Willis Conover knew everything and everyone alive who was Lovecraft-oriented. And he would just show up with various people, and Hans Stefan Santesson along with it, and have me interview them. I'm going, I really don't know who that is. Okay. I knew who Frank Belknap Long was. He was one of the great writers in the Lovecraft circle, and he lived to a bona fide ripe old age. I think he was over 90 when he passed, somewhere in the 80s. And he was a charming man, and yes, I could interview him because I could read his stuff. But then one time Willis Conover came in with this woman, elderly woman by the name of Sonia Green. And, there wasn't Wikipedia in them days. I did not know who Sonia Green was. And Hans takes me aside, just a little bit brusquely, and looks at me and says, "This is Lovecraft's wife." In the words of the Firesign Theater, holy fud. So, you can look her up in Wikipedia to find that out. She died late 1971, so this was probably early 1971. And the recording of that interview, yes, it exists. It exists on acetate, reel-to-reel, in the basement of my house. This is one of the many, many tapes that I have that are in dire need of expensive restoration. Pacifica Archives has done a lot of restoration of their stuff, and we're going to hear a Lovecraft radio drama in just a little bit that they restored from their series Black Mass from KPFA, 1964. But my stuff, they came to BAI just before we moved out of 120 Wall Street, grabbed a lot of stuff, really didn't have too many people who knew a lot about what the archives were and what were in them, and went back to to California with a grant in hand that helped them restore a lot of those recordings. Unfortunately, none of my recordings were in there, so I'm still looking to how do I restore my Frank Herbert interview, my Clifford D. Simak interview. I have hundreds of hours of material, hundreds of hours, and it's a long, arduous process. Max Schmid has done a couple of restoration things for me and says that we actually have material here. Actually, Matt, who's here right now, probably knows how to use it. But it would my tapes, well, they aren't labeled. Cassettes I can do at home if I can find the time. But it's the reel-to-reel tapes. Okay. Oh, and if you want to see a four-minute documentary about that, you go to my Facebook page. Actually, the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. It's the top item there. It's the pinned item. So it's always there, and it's called something like At the Wolf's Door, something like that. But it's a really good documentary made by Cesar Bustamante and photographs by Iman Hassan. Iman has since then become a major photographer for the New York Times. And, oh, yes, by the way, he's really into SF, which is why he chose the assignment of coming to my house and photographing the, I think the right word in this case would be dungeon. Okay. Howard Phillips Lovecraft. Howard Phillips Lovecraft is very, very important in the field of science fiction and fantasy, and particularly horror. He was an American horror writer. So much that comes out of legitimate horror, which is to say non-slasher movie stuff, it's all based on Lovecraft, and sometimes even the people making it don't realize just how Lovecraftian it is. Guillermo del Toro is going to be making a Lovecraftian film soon and has attributed a lot of his horror cinema to Lovecraft, and that's very important whenever you hear about the elder gods and tentacled things that live beneath the earth, like in Cabin in the Woods, a film that's gory. I don't watch gory movies, so I miss out on a lot of horror. It may be good, but I'm never going to see it. There have been any number of movies made based on Lovecraft, usually with other names. Roger Corman made a couple of films. He concentrated more on Edgar Allan Poe. And Lovecraft came up with the Elder Gods. He created a particular god called Cthulhu, C-T-H-U-L-H-U. And Elsbrig de Camp, who wrote a biography of Lovecraft, told me that the proper way to pronounce that particular demon is to put your tongue on the top row of your teeth and sort of cough it out, Cthulhu. And I'm sure I'm not getting it quite right. The human voice isn't quite made to utter these sounds. It's a totally different sound. And from this, a lot of great writers, Clark Ashton Smith and one fellow by the name of Ray Bradbury, was reading Lovecraft's magazines. He was this is a turn of the century, or like the 20s and 30s. Lovecraft was turning out what we called APAs, Amateur Press Associations. He considered himself an amateur journalist. He was mostly published in Weird Tales magazine, and when the original editor of Weird Tales left, he was offered the job of being the next editor, because Weird Tales without Lovecraft just wasn't quite the same in that era. But to do that, he would have had to have moved to Chicago, something he didn't want to do. And another fellow got the job who turned down a lot of Lovecraft's writing, but then, after Lovecraft died, published it anyway. Weird Tales, by the way, still exists. So, Lovecraft moved to Brooklyn. For a while, he was in Red Hook, where he wrote a story called The Horror of Red Hook, and then to Brooklyn Heights, to this really old Gothic, a famous word, eldritch, which is a word commonly associated with Lovecraft. He didn't coin it, but he made it popular. Or sorry, he didn't invent it, but he did coin it. That's a better way to put it. And, he had purple prose. He was very, very, very florid in his writing. Some of the stuff, Pickman's Model, The Dunwich Horror, The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, The Rats in the Halls, is all at the Mountains of Madness, is all classic, classic, classic stuff. If you can get past the prose. But all that aside, he was also a horrific racist. What he thought of immigration makes Donald Trump look like a liberal. In the aforementioned story, The Horror of Red Hook, I think that's the one, he writes about the mud people. That refers to blacks. But he also hated Germans and Irish and Jews. He didn't realize that his wife was part Jewish. She came from Russia. But at least she was white, you see. So that was relatively okay. They didn't live together very long. Again, Sonia Green was a very interesting person, and I suggest that you look her up. That's G-R-E-E-N-E on the end. S-O-N-I-A. Sonia Green. And the horror award, the main award that is given out for horror is the Howie. It's named after Lovecraft. It's a bust of Lovecraft, who was very gaunt, very, well, scary-looking gentleman. It was always my opinion that he wrote horror because he honestly wanted to scare the bejesus out of people. He did not like people. And therefore, he wrote this stuff. That's my personal belief about the guy. And so there is a movement afoot among a lot of today's writers to take Lovecraft off of there. For a while, there was a movement to replace Lovecraft with a person of color, such as Octavia Butler. Only one problem. Octavia never wrote a word of horror in her life, not even her novel Fledgling, which is about a fledgling vampire to a certain extent, but it's more a novel of young discovery. That would be inappropriate. If you want to change that fantasy award, I think the Poe is really the horror award, and Lovecraft, the fantasy award. That's given out at the World Fantasy Organization. I say, make it a unicorn. Make it a dragon. There isn't a culture in the world that doesn't have a dragon. It may be a positive dragon, a negative dragon, but they all have good, spiffy dragons, okay? All right, so, all that aside, I was telling a little bit to Kathy Davis, who's looking at me and saying, well, this guy's so racist, why would you broadcast him? And, well, why do you do Edgar Rice Burroughs? Why do we broadcast Wagner? Why? And the answer is because they offered the world great art. What we have to do is remember this and know, and we're going to get to this discussion after we hear The Rats in the Walls, know that the future of speculative fiction, the future of all fiction, the future of this world is not going to be lily white. Okay? And there is something that I have not discussed, the elephant in the room of science fiction, and that is this year's Hugo Awards, which are being given out this coming Saturday. It is so noteworthy that Wednesday's New York Times had a piece about it. It's been covered by The Atlantic and The Guardian and any number of major press. But now it's made the Times. Oh, here come the sirens for me. You hear that in the background? Is that better? Open some more mics? Okay. So, anyway. So we've got a segue. We've got a segue from the politics of Lovecraft to the modern politics of science fiction awards. But first, let us set the Wayback Machine. God help us, 1964, a mere 51 years in the history of Pacifica Radio to KPFA, the original Pacifica station. The PFA stands for Pacifica. Where was it founded? Where was it located? I'll give you a hint, a science fiction trivia point. The same place where, in the mythos of Star Trek, the Federation is based. In Pacifica, California. It's a neighborhood in Berkeley, California. Okay? That's why we're called Pacifica. The fact that it's a lovely, peaceful name is a very good thing, and no doubt in the mind of the people who came up with that. Nonetheless, from Pacifica Radio, 51 years ago, KPFA, from the series Black Mass, The Rats in the Walls.
Welcome to the Black Mass.
By the way, let me just say, if you, I don't know how the phones here work. If you want to email me, send an email to jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or you can message me on Facebook.
One of the foremost writers of pure horror and the supernatural is H.P. Lovecraft. He regarded all his work as based on the idea that the world was inhabited at one time by another race, which in practicing black magic lost its foothold and was expelled, yet lives on, outside, ever ready to take possession of this earth again. Tonight, we bring you one of his most famous tales, The Rats in the Walls, by H.P. Lovecraft. The restoration of Exham Priory had been a stupendous task. For little had remained of the deserted pile but a shell-like ruin. But because it had been the seat of my ancestors, I let no expense deter me.
The place had not been inhabited since the reign of James the First, when a tragedy of intensely hideous, though largely unexplained nature, occurred. It appeared that my ancestor was accused, with much reason, of having killed all the other members of his household in their sleep. This deliberate slaughter, which included his father, as well as three brothers and two sisters, was strangely condoned by the villagers and slackly treated by the law. With this sole heir nevertheless legally denounced as a murderer, the estate had reverted to the crown, the accused man making no attempt to exculpate himself or regain his property. Shaken by some horror greater than that of conscience or the law, and expressing only a frantic wish to exclude the ancient edifice from his sight and memory, Walter de la Power fled to the United States, where, by the end of several generations, the family had achieved a proud and honorable, if somewhat reserved and unsocial, Virginia line. After the Civil War, the family moved north. I emerged and grew to manhood, to middle age, and to ultimate wealth within the grayness of a Massachusetts business life. My wife, Emily, died shortly after the birth of our only son, Alfred. And Alfred, in the Aviation Corps in 1917. They both had died, leaving me old, bereaved, and aimless, a retired manufacturer. I traveled, eventually to England, eventually to Anchester, eventually to the ancient family seat, Exham Priory itself, a jumble of tottering medieval ruins covered with lichens, perched perilously upon a precipice, denuded of floors and other interior features save the stone walls and the separate towers. The priory had been allotted to the estate of the Norris family by the crown. And now, 3 centuries later, I purchased the ruin for a surprisingly reasonable figure, and resolved to divert my remaining years by restoring my ancestral home. I had secured the interest, assistance, and the friendship of Captain Norris, whose knowledge of the place had been increased through the years by his having accompanied the many architects and antiquarians who loved to examine the strange relic.
Mind your foot on that big stone, yes, over there. Mm-hmm. The architecture, you see, is peculiarly composite. Gothic towers resting over there, yes, on Saxon or Romanesque substructure. The foundation is of a still earlier order, blend of orders, I suppose, Roman, yeah, or even Druidic or native Cymric, if legends speak truly, and merged on the one side, you see, down here, with the, yeah, solid limestone of the precipice.
Amiable Captain Norris, the place and its ancestry had an almost consuming fascination for him. He knew every detail of its history and its former structure, and became of inestimable help in the reconstruction.
The priory itself actually stands on the site of a prehistoric temple.
Yes.
A druidical or anti-druidical thing which must have been contemporary of Stonehenge and dates like that.
Well, it's unfortunate that our neighbors aren't all antiquarians such as you, Captain Norris. I had not been in Anchester a day before I knew I came from an accursed house.
Oh, yes, the country folk around here have their own sense of tradition, I'm afraid. They hated the priory hundreds of years ago when your ancestors lived here. And they hate it now, with the moss and mold of abandonment on it. We'll have to go outside of the immediate vicinity for our workers. You see, it isn't so much hatred as the almost unbelievable fear they have of the place. And the scope appears to include both the priory and, I'm afraid, its ancient family.
Yes, I don't seem to be able to convince the villagers how little I know of my heritage.
Oh, but to them a lineage is beyond a message of knowing. It's in the bone and blood itself. Yes. I'm not sure I disagree. But what do we see? After 3 centuries, a power has returned to his ancient site to reconstruct the very house. And for the villagers, you've come to restore a symbol abhorrent to them.
Oh.
Rational or not, you know, they view Exham Priory as nothing less than a haunt of fiends and werewolves.
Captain Norris, superstitions. Well, superstitions, ghosts and goblins.
Oh, no, not quite that.
You share their worries, nevertheless.
Well, so would you, Power. Yeah. It's not a matter of the present, and it's not all superstition.
Yeah.
This is an ancient place, Power. That indescribable rites had been celebrated here, no one doubts. Rites of the Sibylle worship, which the Romans had introduced. Yes, inscriptions, yes, still visible in the subcellar of the priory, bear the unmistakable letters and signs of Magna Mater, whose dark worship was once vainly forbidden to Roman citizens.
Mm.
About 1000 A.D., the place is mentioned as being a substantial stone priory housing a strange and powerful monastic order and surrounded by extensive gardens. You will see them right over there.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, mind that stone there. You know, the people didn't need any walls to keep them out. They were too frightened of the place altogether.
Mm-hmm.
It was never destroyed by the Danes, oddly enough. After the Norman conquest, it must have declined tremendously. There was no impediment when Henry III granted the site to your ancestor, Gilbert de la Poer, he was called then, first Baron Exham in, I think, 1261.
Yes, well, then it's the location, the house, not the family that inherits the bad name.
Well, they became aligned, you see. And not, so far as we know, unwillingly. True, before their occupation, the family bore no evil report, but something strange must soon have occurred. You know, in one chronicle, there's a reference to Adela Poer as cursed of God. It's a strange phrase. Village legendary had nothing but evil and frantic fear to tell of the castle. The fireside tales were of the most grisly description. All the ghastlier because of their frightened reticence and cloudy evasiveness. I'm afraid they represented your ancestors as a race of hereditary demons. Yes.
But what precisely happened, Norris? What went on?
Well, there are the vaguer tales. Hackneyed spectral lore, perhaps. Wails and the usual howlings heard around the place. Graveyard stench after the spring rains. The servant girl who'd gone mad at what she saw in the full light of day in the priory. The accounts of vanished peasants are less to be dismissed, though not especially significant in view of medieval custom. Prying curiosity meant death. And yes, more than one severed head had been publicly shown on the bastions around Exham Priory.
Ah, yes.
Well, it's difficult. A few of the tales were exceedingly picturesque. For instance, the belief that a legend of bat-winged devils kept witches' Sabbath each night at the priory, a legend whose sustenance must explain the disproportionate abundance of coarse vegetables harvested in the gardens. But most vivid of all, there was the dramatic epic of the rats.
The rats?
Yes, the scampering army of obscene vermin which had burst forth from the castle a couple of months after the tragedy that doomed the place to desertion 3 centuries ago now. You know, a lean, filthy, ravenous army which had swept all before it and devoured fowl, cats, dogs, hogs, sheep, and, you know, even 2 villagers before its fury was spent. Yes, around that unforgettable rodent army a cycle of myths revolved. Scattered among the village homes and brought curses and horrors in its train.
Yes, and that was just 3 months after Walter de la Power had murdered his family and fled to Virginia.
Yes, I should say about that.
You know, one thing puzzles me about that murder. Walter de la Power must have known for years the sinister tales about his family, so that this material could have given him no fresh impulse. I can scarcely conjecture what discovery could have prompted an act so terrible. What had he witnessed or stumbled upon?
Take this path down here.
Yes.
The general whispered sentiment seems to have been that he purged the land of immemorial curse.
Such was the law that assailed me as I began, with an elderly obstinacy, the work of restoring my ancestral home. While living with Captain Norrie's family during the restoration of the priory, I collected many such tales of superstition or fact. But it must not be imagined that they formed my principal psychological environment. I was constantly praised and encouraged by Captain Norrie's and the antiquarians who surrounded and aided me. When the task was done, over 2 years after its commencement, I viewed the great rooms with pride. Wainscoted walls, vaulted ceilings, mullioned windows, broad staircases, all there, all as it had been, every attribute of the Middle Ages was cunningly reproduced. The new parts blended perfectly with the original stone walls and foundations. The seat of my father's was complete, and I looked forward to redeeming at last the local fame of the line, which ended with me. The interior of the old house was, in truth, wholly new, and free from old vermin and old ghosts. The first incident occurred 6 days after I moved into the priory. That night, dispensing as usual with a valet, I retired to the West Tower chamber, which I had chosen as my own. The room was circular, very high, and without wainscoting, the stones being hung with tapestries. I did not draw the curtains, but gazed out at the narrow north window, which I faced from the canopied four-poster. At sometime I must have fallen quietly asleep, for I recall a distinct sense of leaving strange dreams. As I awoke, I found myself looking intensely at a point on the wall, a point to which my eye had nothing to mark it, but toward which all my attention was directed. Whether the tapestry actually moved, I cannot say. I think it did very slightly. But what I can swear to is that behind it I heard a low, distinct scurrying, as of mice or rats. Then it was gone. Some sort of effect of echo, perhaps, coming from some other area of the house. There was no need of my looking behind the arras, for the walls were of solid stone, several feet thick. It was a while before I could drift back to sleep, and I seemed directly to re-enter my earlier dream, except that this time the vision was clearly, horribly before me. I seemed to be looking down from an immense height upon a twilit grotto, knee-deep with filth, where a white-bearded demon, a swineherd, drove about with his staff a flock of fungus beasts, whose appearance filled me with unutterable loathing. Then, as the swineherd paused and nodded over his task, a mighty swarm of rats rained down on the stinking abyss and fell to devouring beasts and man alike. But suddenly I was awake, wide awake. On every side of the chamber, the walls were alive with nauseous sound. The verminous slithering of ravenous, gigantic rats. I could see a hideous shaking all over the tapestry. But the motion disappeared almost at once, and the sound with it. I sprang out of bed and tore aside the arras to see what lay beneath it. Nothing. Nothing but the patched stone wall. I stepped out of the room and stood for a moment at the head of the great ancient stairway, listening. Listening to the house. I could hear them. I could hear them faintly at first, but coming from all the walls. And as I descended, the stampeding continued with such force and distinctness that I could finally assign to their motions a definite direction. These creatures, in numbers apparently inexhaustible, were engaged in one stupendous migration from inconceivable heights to some depth inconceivably below.
Rats?
When I questioned the servants, they said they heard nothing. I didn't want to alarm them by insisting. No, I wasn't dreaming, Norris. It was no dream.
But there have been no rats at the Priory for 300 years. Even the field mice couldn't be found in these high walls.
Wherever would they be found in walls of solid stone?
You say they were headed downward.
Captain Norris helped me explore the subcellar, but absolutely nothing untoward was found. We could not, however, repress a thrill at the knowledge that this vault was built by Roman hands.
You see up here, it's not the debased Romanesque of the bungling Saxons, but the severe and harmonious classicism of the age of the Caesars. Look here at these inscriptions. T.M. Temp. Dona Lucius Praecius Pontificatus. What is it? Attis. Yes. Attis.
The reference made me shiver, but I had read Catullus and knew something of the hideous rites of the Eastern god, whose worship was so mixed with that of Sibylle.
Look, hold your lantern up here. No, not that yes. One. That, by this stone block here.
Oh, yes, I see.
Yes, you see the design cut into it? A sort of rayed sun? That's not Roman. No, that's not Roman at all. It's of an earlier origin. These altars had merely been adopted by the Roman priests from some older, perhaps aboriginal temple on the same site. Come down here. Let's have a look down here.
Norris and I determined to pass the night in the crypt, and couches were brought down by the servants. We retired with the lanterns still burning to await whatever might occur. The vault was very deep in the foundations of the priory, and that it had been the goal of the scuffling and unexplainable rats, I could not doubt. But why? Why? As we lay there expectantly, I found my vigil occasionally mixed with half-formed dreams. I saw the twilight grotto and the swineherd. The fungus beasts wallowing in filth. They seemed nearer, nearer and more distinct. I could almost observe their features. Beasts, but not exactly beasts. They became more distinct as I watched, looking up at me. Terrifying, terrifying. Norris! Norris, wake up, Norris! Wake up, wake
what
up!
Is it, what's wrong?
Do you hear? Did you hear them? Did you hear them, Norris?
No. What?
The rats!
Rats? I heard nothing at all.
Still downward. They were going still farther down.
No.
There are cellars below us, Norris!
Cellars?
Norris, was it hallucination? Possibly. Was it madness? Why have they stopped? Why have they stopped? Why is it silent now?
Perhaps you've been shown what certain forces wish to show you.
They were headed downward. In this altar. See, Norris. The lantern flickers at the crevice here between the altar and the floor. There must be some kind of...
By Jove!
There must be some way of descending, some door, some kind of entrance.
Balanced by some sort of counterweight, I expect. You see, look here, look. Yes. The entire stone pivots aside. There's your cellar power.
A horror. A horror. Oh. St- stone steps descended into an abysmal dark, but scrawled across them, as far as we could see, skeletons, attitudes of panic, fear, all over them, the marks of rodent gnawings, a ghastly array of human or semi-human bones, cretinism, semi-apedom. We descended the hellishly littered steps.
Horrifying, but extraordinary. Look here. Out through solid rock. Notice the strokes here. Look, according to the direction of wind, this passage must have been chiseled from beneath, upward. You know? Look at that. You notice the air? There's a cool movement of air. Probably some fissure in the cliffs above. Yes, look, Pa. The stairway ends here. There's light filtering down from somewhere up here. I can't quite see it, but... Hey, it must be morning outside. You know, almost enough light to see. It's a sort of grotto. Enormous. You can just barely...
The descent from reality had almost prepared me for what was to come. Norris, when I reached him, stared out with a look resembling that of the skulls at his feet. Then I followed his eyes over the subterranean world before us. Dear God.
We must not underestimate the archaeological importance of such a discovery as this, Power.
The twilight grotto was of enormous height and stretched farther than any eye could see. There were buildings and other architectural remains. In the center, a circle of monoliths, but dwarfed by the spectacle on the ground. An insane tangle of bones, human or nearly so. Like a foamy sea, they stretched pastures of demonic frenzy, either fighting off some menace or clutching other forms with cannibal intent.
Yes, these skulls suggest a rather baffling mixture. Mostly lower in the scale of evolution than Pythic Anthropus, but in every case definitely human. Actually, some of them seem to be supremely and sensitively developed types.
Horror. Horror upon horror.
All the bones gnawed.
Altars serving as butcher shop and kitchen.
Mostly by rats.
Cauldrons. Dining tables.
Not all by rats, by Jove.
Goblets brown stained and dry. Horror upon horror.
Notice the stone pens over here, for the keeping of herd, I expect, and out of which they must have broken in their last delirium of hunger or rat fear. Herds of some primordial human type. Yes, fascinating. And there a row of cells, nearly rusted through. Their tenants still locked inside.
And on the bony forefinger of one, a seal ring with my own coat of arms.
Strange ideographic carvings here on some of the skulls. Here. Look at this, Pa. You know, I believe they're Phrygian in origin. Cases of formally arranged bones with parallel inscriptions in Greek and Latin.
Still downward, I could hear them. Where else could they draw me? Across the grotto. Carrion pits of sawed bones, picked bones, open skulls, nightmare chasms, unhallowed centuries grinning their unnameable fancies. Then to the edge of a depth hideously foreshadowed by my dreams.
An apparently boundless depth. Power, there's no end to it. A great mouth, lined with human debris, spewing, swallowing, yawning out from the primordial... Power, stay out of it! Stay out of it, man!
The rats, questing new horrors, determined to lead me on. I ran, following them,
Power! I heard voices, echoes, but above all that insidious scurrying. I felt them all around me. I was one of them, part of the ravenous army that feasts on the living and the dead. Well, why shouldn't rats eat a de la power, as a de la power eats forbidden things? No. No, no, I am not that demon in the twilight grotto. It's not Nari's body I tear apart. It's not blood I feast upon, and flesh. You faint and fear at what my family do. Hot blood, thou stink, and I'll learn you how to gush. World is wine, give me the wine. Magna Mater! Magna Mater! Atis! Augustus Durgot!
That is what they said. I said, when they found me in the blackness, over the half-eaten body of Captain Nares. Now they have blown up Hexham Priory and shut me into this barred room at Hanwell. With fearful whispers about my heredity and experience. When I speak of poor Nares, they accuse me of a hideous thing. But they must know that I did not do it. I did not do it. They must know it was the rats. It was the rats whose scampering will never let me sleep. The demon rats that race behind the padding of this room and beckon me down to greater horrors than I have ever known. The rats. They can never hear. The rats in the walls.
That was The Rats in the Walls by H.P. Lovecraft. The technical production was by John Whiting. The part of Captain Norris was played by Bernard Mays. The part of De La Power and the adaptation were by your host of The Black Mass, Eric Bauersfeld. And now, good night.
say. Listen to the sound, hear them all around. Listen to the sound, hear them all around. Standing there, eyes on
H.P. Lovecraft. No. Okay, at least I got the thing to advance to the next song, but of course I've got to nip that in the bud. H.P. Lovecraft, author of The Rats in the Walls. You heard a 1964 KPFA production. And after that, the band H.P. Lovecraft from 1968 from their album H.P. Lovecraft 2, At the Mountains of Madness. What does that song actually have to do with Lovecraft? As far as I can tell, probably nothing. But then again, it's too blissed out, man. You know, you just really can't do the lyrics. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM, and also over WBAI.org. And this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction and fantasy and related fields of endeavor. And we have been noting the 125th birthday, August 20th, 2015, 125th birthday of H.P. Lovecraft, a formative figure in the world of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. Currently still the icon of the World Fantasy Award, though I suspect that is going to change. And speaking of awards, I usually discuss awards, notably the Hugo Awards and the Nebula Awards, in advance of their coming out. And this year, people may have noted that I have been uncommonly quiet, at least about the Hugos. And this is not without reason. They have been getting, plenty of coverage. I mean, even yesterday's New York Times, Wednesday's New York Times, had a couple of links to some very interesting, very pertinent articles about why the Hugos, which are being given out this Saturday in Spokane, Washington, are important. And here's the deal. The Nebula Awards are given out by Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, are a peer award. You have to be an active member of that organization to be able to vote for the Nebula Award. The Hugo, and that also includes, of course, nominations. Pardon me while I try to figure out some of the... There we go, yes. My mic is live. It's hardly playing into my headphones. So, not sure about that, but it seems to be okay. So, anyway, the Hugo Awards is a popularity award. And right there, while the Hugo is the much better known award, to me, the Nebula Award, which is given out only, you know, relatively recently, historically, I think it started in 65, the Nebula, the Hugo, is the popularity contest. The Nebula is the peer award. So for me, the peer award is the more, well, prestigious of the two. It says more. But one should not disregard the acclaim of fandom. But unfortunately, very often, fandom, it just says that it's popular. It does not always necessarily speak to quality. Not necessarily. But here's the greater problem with the Hugo. The Hugo is an open democracy. Anybody can vote. You pays your $40 to become a supporting member. If you're an attending member of the convention, obviously you pay more. But you can be a supporting member, and you can nominate, and you can vote. One organism, one vote. And therein lies the problem. This can be gamed. Somebody can buy a huge number of memberships and give them out to people in their organization and say, hey, everybody, here's a free membership to Worldcon. You can vote. And this has happened. Some years ago, an organization called Scientology, which is a group that was largely born out of science fiction fandom, something that the recent movie and otherwise fine book on Scientology sort of glosses over the importance of science fiction and Scientology. It's almost mentioned in passing, whereas those of us who are intimate with the workings of science fiction fandom, well, we know better. We know more. But anyway, at one time it was alleged Scientology bought a whole bunch of memberships and handed them out to people so that they could vote for members of their other, you know, perfectly worthy organization, the Writers of the Future Conference, which is they give out grants. I know some of the people who have won this award, and you know what? They're good. They're not Scientologists. The people who issue the awards are not. The people who promote them, on the other hand, are. But suffice it to say, what happened was that they used consecutive money orders, I believe. They had money orders with consecutive numbers. And so somebody who's counting the ballots is going, whoa, 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 hey. This is all coming from one source, and it was invalidated. Didn't happen. This year it did. For about 3 years, a fellow by the name and oh, I hope I pronounce this correctly, Larry Correia, C-O-R-R-E-I-A, has been promoting a slate telling people how he would like to vote. And he has an organization based on a blog that he runs called The Sad Puppies. And what the sad puppies say is, you know, all science fiction, it's not about rocket ships anymore. Science, it's not about white people colonizing other planets. It's become an affirmative action. My God, there are homosexuals writing this stuff, and the Hugos have become this thing, and I suppose Nebulas as well, that are just going to promote SJWs. By that they mean social justice warriors. So, we encourage people to pay your $40, buy your membership into the World Science Fiction Convention, and nominate the following books. Okay, and that's not a huge deal. Other people, including people on the side of the social justice warriors, have made recommendations saying, I think that the following awards are Hugo worthy. And they may note that people like N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, who read just tonight for the KGB Fantastic Fiction readings along with Allison Wise. Two women. And one of them, black. Oh, my God! What's happening to science fiction? Black people are writing science fiction. Black women! Oh, my God! This is terrible! This is horrible! Well, this wasn't even so bad. These are people calling themselves the sad puppies. To which I say, okay, let's get a rolled-up newspaper and deal with that. However, then there came along another group. The rabbit puppies. They're not just sad, they're rabid, and oh my, are they ever. A blogger and publisher, I would say wannabe publisher, but he actually publishes stuff, by the name of Theodore Beale, who uses the pseudonym Vox Day, has his publishing company based out of all places, Finland. And he buys stories and books from about six or seven people. And he, too, had a slate. So these two groups altogether, the sad puppies and the angry puppies, who I call the rabid puppies, as a group altogether, came together and gamed the freaking Hugo nominations. Now, that's not that big a deal. Not that many people vote for the nominations. As few as 50 people voting for a particular novel can make something Hugo nominated. As I said, it's like the People's Choice Awards. And this year, they done it. When the Hugo nominations were counted and came out, there were any number of categories. There's at least one category in which there are only people from that slate. In one of them, there were people from a different slate, you know, who weren't in that slate and found themselves like the only person not in that slate who actually withdrew their nominations for a Hugo. And that's a sad, sad, sad thing to say. Yeah, this could change my career. Yeah, this could change. And what's more, they'd probably win. But they didn't want, and here I'm putting thoughts in their mouths or minds, but this is a fair assumption. They didn't want to win on the basis that they were the only people to vote for, because otherwise you're voting for some right-wing, religious right wing, by the way. Crazy person. Now, the sad puppies are simply throwbacks. But the angry puppies are an agenda. They both have agendas. But they're a serious, nasty agenda. Okay? And so... So there was a piece on NPR today. Why the major media have ignored this until now, I don't know. The Guardian, British newspaper The Guardian, has been following this all along. The Atlantic Monthly had a wonderful, really, really good article on how even if the awards have been gamed, even if that has come up somehow. Let's see, and I'm trying to find the name of the woman who wrote it. Where's your byline? Cameron Hurley. That's Cameron with a K. Cameron Hurley. This was published back in April, and she had a headline that I think says the whole article, and beyond that, you can look it up for yourself. It's at theatlantic.com, and it's called Hijacking the Hugo Awards Won't Stifle Diversity in Science Fiction. You know what? Even if the awards are gamed, even if the awards are given out to the wrong people, and I don't believe they will be, but they did game the nominations, that's not going to prevent what people are writing. When you tune in Hour of the Wolf, and when I have guests, I hope that you're hearing diverse people. I hope that you're hearing diverse cultures. I hope that you're hearing, I call them gay, they call themselves queer writers, women of color, women not of color, women, diverse cultures, just starting to find its way into the field now. Great writers like Ken Liu and I have to look at his name to even say it properly, and I still won't say it properly. Tzixin Liu, it's C-I-X-I-N-L-I-U. And let me tell you, my mouth isn't really perfect at that. When I introduce his fiction on the Lightspeed Magazine podcast, and by the way, we're nominated for Hugo again this year. We won last year, and we're up this year for Best Semi-Prozine, so I hope we win. But anyway, I work on the podcast. I'm the host of the podcasts. But you go to lightspeedmagazine.com or check out my Facebook page, and you'll see the links so you can hear them. Just finished editing one by Sam J. Miller that is really, really good. Anyway, science fiction has not yet opened its doors to everybody. When Margot Adler began this program in 1972, women were just becoming a major part of science fiction publishing. They were... And that's largely thanks, I think, to an anthology by Pamela Sargent called Women of Wonder, and breakthroughs by people like Ursula K. Le Guin and Joanna Russ. And before that, people were publishing under ambiguous names like Lee Brackett, who, by the way, this is her centenary. I just found out during this program. Going to have to do something about that because she's a wonderful writer, great screenplay writer as well. She wrote everything from The Big Sleep for Howard Hawks, co-wrote that with some guy named Faulkner, to The Long Goodbye for Robert Altman, and then she wrote some movie called The Empire Strikes Back that you may have heard of. I mean, she's a great, great writer, and she wrote a lot of great, great science fiction, as did her husband, Edmond Hamilton, who's one of the key sources for the original Star Wars. Anyway. These people were not acknowledged as women writing all this science fiction. So in the 70s, when Hour of the Wolf began, it was just beginning to happen. The consciousness of people in SF were just beginning to recognize that. Then, really, in terms of getting new outreach, new groups into science fiction, there was still just a vague smattering of gay science fiction. Some was there, and that's largely thanks to Samuel R. Delaney, staff member at WBAI and a black gay man. And this is very evident in such important books as Dahlgren, published 1975. That began changing as well. And then in 2000, Cherie Renee Thomas, with her book Dark Matter, opened the floodgates to people recognizing people from the, as she terms it for her anthology Dark Matter, speculative fiction from the African diaspora. And that opened some floodgates as well. And so now, the short fiction, the novels, the fact that N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, can't write a book that doesn't get nominated, deservedly so. I hope that she finally wins. Her new book, The Fifth Season, by the way, is just out. And now we have The Three-Body Problem, translated by Ken Liu and written by Tzitzin Liu, Chinese, Asian science fiction. This is becoming major, and it's driving these puppies to distraction. Okay? They can't deal with it. They are about as open to outsiders as H.P. Lovecraft was 90 years ago. Let me tell you something. Not only won't gaming the Hugo Awards stifle diversity, because this stuff is still going to be published, even if it doesn't win the Hugos, it's still what's going to be dominating the field, because that's the freaking future. Okay? By 2050, blacks are not going to be the minority in the United States anymore. So who do you think is going to be writing, judging, saying, creating art? It's going to be lots of people from lots of backgrounds and lots of places. And science fiction, the literature of the future, people, is going to darned well do that. So, all you puppies, go back to your kennel. So, this year, on Saturday, the Hugos will be presented. And while the nominees have been largely gained, there's one person, one award that is in every single category that is very likely to win some of those categories. It's called No Award. You see, you don't have to vote for one or another. What you do is you vote your preference. You mark them number one, two, three, your favorites. And then number one, your choice can be No Award. Number three can be your choice, No Award. So when you take a look, you know, best novel, that's actually pretty open. That's Ancillary Sword by Anne Leckie, The Dark Between the Stars by Kevin Anderson, The Goblin Emperor by Catherine Addison, The Three-Body Problem by Tzu Liu, Skin Game by Jim Butcher. Oh, gee, there's diversity. Now we get to novella. Big Boys Don't Cry by Tom Kratman. Castalia House. Now, Castalia House is edited by this fellow calling himself Vox Day. Right there. Flow by Arlen Andrews, Sr. Analog. Okay. One Bright Star to Guide Them by John C. Wright. Castalia House. Pale Realms of Shade by John C. Wright. Ooh. Two nominations. Castalia House. The Plural of Helen of Troy by John C. Wright. Castalia House. That's out of five nominees, four from one publisher of the religious right. And right there, that's one, two, three nominations for the same writer, who isn't the worst writer in the world. Once upon a time, he was even a really nice guy. I've met him, but he went through some kind of religious epiphany. He's gone to the religious right, and this is what John Wright writes. Similar thing starts happening. Okay, so the best novelette category seems to be pretty open. It's really the novella category. Now, here's an interesting thing. There were 2,100 valid nominating ballots received, and usually that number is closer to 1,000. This year, the number of voters for the Hugo Award is an all-time high. 10,000 members of the con, some 5,000 people voting. So the winners, no, they're not going to be gamed. They weren't, they won't be. And when the Worldcon changes its rules this year, as they do every year, there's a business meeting. Oh, my God, is that going to be a freaking circus? Well, I would talk more about the Hugos and what I think should have won, or because probably most of the things that I voted for won't be winning. And, yes, I had to vote no award on a few things. I haven't even voted for the Hugos in years. But this year, there was a responsibility to do it. Because of these freaking right-wingers trying to game the sucker. Well, you know what? I do have a message for those people. And I didn't do that into the microphone because Lister is coming on the air with Burn Baby Burn and he don't need my germs. Thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next week, I believe, with guests on the phone, Dan Persons, discussing the summer films coming to an end and a preview of what's coming up in the fall and winters, that Star Wars stuff, Star Trek, so on and so forth. You can write me, jim@ourwolf.com, or check me out on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group. Don't forget, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings starts September 8th with Michael Swanrick and Rajan Khanna. That's going to be a good one. So, again, thank you for listening. Please, everybody, be good to each other. We all deserve it. Have a good morning.
But I'm glowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover. take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag to.
Différence. café. Long time, presente dando el bate, hace tiempo ya. Porque sé que muy dentro de mí solo soy falla. Tiempo hace ya, y mi boca no calla. Porque sé que la guerra no es solo una batalla.
Ça fait long time que l'on joue ces belles mélodies. Long time, Sergent Garcia est dans la partie. Entre nous c'est sincère, il n'a pas d'hypocrisie. Adam et Finn, salsa, reggae, roots and crunch, attendez.
Enciende el televisor y mira la pantalla. Se oyen ruidos de botas, movimientos de patrulla. En mi radio solo se escucha mala noticia. Codicia, injusticia, yo no sigo esa vía.
Bayonique et Sergent, on est là et on ne lâchera pas au combat. Nous allons, mon frère, dans le même sens. De différence, la main dans la main, yes, on avance au combat. C'est la vérité, je le dis et je le pense. Ça fait
long time qu'on est ensemble, long time qu'on se connaît, long time qu'on se fait confiance. Entre nous, pas de différence, ça fait long time, long time. Entre nous pas de différence, ça fait long time.
Ça café enchaîne, maman connaît vos talents. Ça café long time, nos pas jamais fait de la voix. Ensemble, nos amènes à différents combats. Attends, on s'est ancré, nos propriétés. Ayanaï, force nous, amis chez nous et pas les confailles. Les nous et nos jeunes, nos papis, soins faits pour style. On va pas croire nos lendemains, les nos gars travaillent. Ensemble, bailleurs, sergents, café fait en caille, mucho tiempo.
Día, noche, noche, yo sigo luchando para que poco a poco todo vaya cambiando. Mucho tiempo, Bionic Sargento combinando. Mucho tiempo, juntos en los mismos caminos. Mucho tiempo, cruzando los mismos ríos. Paso a paso, poco a poco, yo voy caminando.
Long time,
con el corazón. Long time, con su corazón. Long time, con su fe confianza. Entre nous, pas de différence. Long time qu'on se connaît, long time qu'on se fait confiance. Entre nous pas de différence, ça fait long time, long time qu'on est ensemble, long time qu'on se connaît, long time qu'on se fait confiance. Entre nous pas de différence, ça fait long time, long time.
Dance with me.
Talk with me.
You come on and dance with me. with me.
And you're in tune to Round the Station.